Well, let's give this a try. Separate it again, and let's see how it goes from here. So, we have Herbert Hoover being blamed for this stuff, and a new president is elected, this time a Democrat. His name is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And if that last name sounds familiar, you certainly, I mean, he's one of our most famous presidents, of course, but he is, in fact, related to Theodore Roosevelt. He's a distant cousin, and I don't mean to confuse things, but he also becomes his nephew when he marries Theodore Roosevelt's niece. So this is a little bit of close family connections here, but you needn't concern yourself with that. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He's a Democrat, and Democrats take a different approach to the economy. They believe in heavy government intervention. So he starts a whole series of projects, especially because for a few years now, so Herbert Hoover was president, and then the Depression happened, and then for a few years he didn't really actively take measures to fix it, and people wanted someone new. So there's been a few years of this Depression by the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt comes into office, and he can clearly see that people want the government to take some sort of action. And he does. He starts a bunch of programs, projects. He has this, what's called a New Deal. A New Deal. Theodore Roosevelt had his thing. He called it a Square Deal, but now Franklin Delano Roosevelt has this New Deal, and it's a whole bunch of public works projects. The government is going to hire people, everything like that. Basically government spending, which I explained before was a part of fiscal policy. And this helped people. This definitely helped people. But it's really a toss-up. People argue to this day about whether it helped end the Great Depression or actually whether it helped prolong it. You see, the government doesn't really have money to give to you. The government doesn't have that. It takes money from the people in the form of taxes, uses money for itself to sustain itself, to pay its wages, buildings, electricity, everything like that, and then distributes some of the remaining money back to the people. So many would argue, if it's being taken from the people only to have some of it given back to the people, why not cut out the middleman and just let people keep their own money? That's an argument. There's also a criticism that, hey, there's a crowding out effect. What does that mean? The government choosing to spend on whatever it is, new roads or a dam for a river, something like that, means that money didn't get used for something else, means the people employed for that task didn't get employed somewhere else. Maybe they would have been forced to invent something or come up with something. As they say, necessity is the mother of invention. And so when people are forced to figure out a way to earn a living, that's when they really learn how to earn a living. So those arguments go on to this very day between the political parties and even beyond that about how government should interact with the economy, if at all. So there is also another problem going on, which is known as the Dust Bowl. The Dust Bowl. Here, with what would you think? Well, these states in the middle of the country, the Great Plains, as they're known, a lot of farmers in that area. Well, they had recently come into that area and started farming. Now, bad luck for them. They probably thought it was good luck, but they went to these areas, and it happened to be years when it was raining quite well. It's not normal, but it happened to be years when it was raining quite well. And they thought, okay, it's always going to be this way. And then when they broke up the land for farming, they took out a lot of the ingrown vegetation and whatnot, which is useless to humans, but it was useful in holding the earth where it was. Things evolved for a certain reason. Everything, insects, people, you know, on the first day of class, I think I explained to you, you know, why so many of us have back problems, because the human body evolved from crawling on all fours to walking upright. So the back was really meant to be a suspension system, but we're using it like a ladder. The saying is, it's meant to be a clothesline, but we're using it like a ladder. And so everything evolved. These viruses and everything, they evolved. You might be wondering, oh, thank goodness there aren't viruses that kill immediately or instantly. Well, there probably have been. There almost certainly have been. But what happened? They died out because they killed too quickly. When we try and kill insects, a lot of times we use slow-acting poisons because we want them to take the poison out to the fellow insects and spread the poison. We don't want it to kill too quickly. When you see animals, you know, I had explained earlier about Darwin in an earlier lecture and survival of the fittest and evolution and natural selection, and that's true of everything, really. When you see animal evolution of cats, for example, you see that tigers are striped because the environment they're in, with the tall grass, which they're naturally in, that helps them blend in. You see with jaguars and pumas, they're solid colored. The nocturnal ones, the night ones, are black. The other ones have a beige color because they're in this desert type area, so they blend in that way. Leopards, as they're going through the jungle canopy and the sunlight is coming down through it, it's very dappled, and so their spots help them blend in. There's all kinds of evolutionary features and things like that. Even like polar bears, I go into in the World Civ 1 class I teach, I go into this a lot, very deeply, and I go into polar bears and camels and everything like that, because I use, again, you know, jumping around here to these different examples, you need to use different examples to illustrate the point. If I just kept talking about say jaguars, people would think, oh, I'm talking about jaguars. When I mix it up with different kind of cats, okay, it's more general. When I mix in other creatures, okay, that's still more general. And when I mix in evolutionary features of all these different types of things, even vegetation, you know, strawberries, they're tasty, they're sweet, they're red, eye-catching, everything like that. Why is that? Because they've got these seeds in them and they want creatures to eat them and carry them off, whether they're birds or whatever it is, and then carry them off, and then when they eventually defecate, it spreads the seeds. And that's how it reproduces more and more and more. And before the seeds are ready, they don't want creatures to eat it. So the strawberries are green, and they have a very sour taste. It's the opposite of what people would desire. It's very sour because they want to signal to creatures, don't eat it. And they want it to be sour because the seeds aren't ready to spread. It would be pointless to have it eaten at that time because it can't reproduce that way. It's all kinds of things. I like the animal examples better when you see a skunk stripe and everything like that. There's a reason it looks so distinctive, because it needs to signal. You know, its strength is as a deterrent. It's not like a lion, which can fight in close range. And it's showing it's strong, but it can fight in close range. That skunk can spray this really smelly substance on anything that attacks it, and then nothing will want to mate with it. Other creatures won't want to come near it. So that has no effect. That won't save the skunk. That won't protect the skunk. It will only deter attackers. And so that deterrent effect is why it needs to broadcast that it has this weapon, that it's a skunk. Don't come near it. And all these lessons, I mean, they apply in so many ways. You can talk about nuclear deterrence in the Cold War, which we'll talk about later, between the Soviet Union and the United States, mutually assured destruction. Actually, the fact that we both had nuclear weapons acted as a deterrent, where we did not go to war with each other because we would have annihilated each other. So all these, whether in business, whether in whatever you're looking at, these concepts and these principles apply. But anyway, this would really tie in 100 different ways to what we're talking about right now, because everything is connected to everything. I mean, I, from a business sense and from a combat sense and everything like that, whether it be martial arts or whatever it is, I tend to look at things very strategically. And somebody else might be more impressed with things like, okay, polar bear needs to be camouflaged, right? Not because it needs to hide from predators, but because it needs to hide from prey. It doesn't want to announce itself too early. And, you know, that's why its fur is what color? Trick question. It's not white. It's transparent or translucent. It's and it's reflecting the light back, and pure light is white. So that's why it looks like the fur is white, even though it's really clear. And then, well, what about, you know, like I said with the Apple thing, you want the best of both worlds. With Apple computers, Steve Jobs did that for his company. You know, it's super cold up in the North Pole area and in the Arctic. So shouldn't it have dark colors so it can save its warmth? Well, its skin is black, you know, and although other people might be, you know, what resonates for you is what resonates for you. That's what the right lesson is for you. If it's that it makes you see things in a new way, it makes you, you know, we talked about transhumanism and just, you know, what if this is all a simulation, and what if we've lived before, and this is now where we're being brought back to life in a computer and everything like that. There's all kinds of things we can talk about with déjà vu. Déjà vu, which is seeing something new as though we've seen it before. We have that feeling that we've seen it before. And there's a explanation for that, a reaction in the brain that actually causes that, déjà vu. Well, it's been said there's also vu déjà. What is that? I never heard of that, right? Well, that's seeing something familiar in a new way. So déjà vu is seeing something new as though you've seen it before. Vu déjà, it's been said, is the ability or the experience of seeing something we already know as something new, like we've never seen it before. And that's a very valuable skill. It's a very important skill in everything we look at. So while I might be more interested in the tactical and strategic aspect and the polar bear, it has larger paws and its paws are dimpled, so it gives it a better grip, and the larger paws also distribute the weight. These polar bears are very heavy animals, and they're walking on ice, you know, so you want to distribute the weight better. When we talk about World War II and other things, you know, these tanks are very heavy, and with the wider treads, it allowed the weight to be distributed better and also give it better grip. So all these principles are the same thing, no matter what we're looking at. When you see in World War II, again, you know, they had the sloped armor. They invented angled armor for the tanks, where it's deflecting the incoming shots. And it's also got another benefit to it. It's actually, when you hit straight at something angled, you're now going through a lot more of the surface, a lot more material. If you just pick up a book, if there's a book near you, and just hit it at a perpendicular angle with your hand, just slowly stab at it with a pencil or something like that, you see how much material it's going through. Now do that again with your pencil or your hand or something, but angle the book at 45 degrees. And do you see how much more material it has to penetrate? So that's one of the things we used on the tanks. It's one of the things we use in Muay Thai when you're shielding with the leg, when somebody's kicking at your thigh. You lift your leg up and block it with your shin, okay? But if you angle your shin, if you don't keep it perpendicular to the ground, now it's not only deflecting the shot a lot, but it's also more material, that more bone and muscle that his kick has to get through. When you see, why is the sky blue? What's going on there? It's because when the sun is shining down, when you see it directly above us, and this goes again to what I was saying, you see everything is connected to everything, even unintentionally. Pure light is white. So if you ever look at the sun, which you should not, directly, when it's directly above you, you'll see it as white. Because the light is coming and penetrating directly through our atmosphere and it's at its strongest. As the sun starts to set, or rise, whatever it is, it's coming through the atmosphere at an angle. So let's say it's the sun is setting. You'll see the sky and everything turn different colors, especially when it's just about to set. You'll see it as reddish, the clouds and everything like that. Why is that? Because the sky is blue because when you see the color spectrum, like a rainbow and everything like that, you've got these colors from strongest to weakest, and blue is one of the weakest colors. And it's too weak to fully get through the atmosphere when the sun is directly above us, so it's getting diffused and turning the whole sky blue, because the blue part of the spectrum can't penetrate, it's too weak. But as the sun is setting or rising, you can see it's got, the sunlight has to go through so much more atmosphere, the blue is not getting through at all, and even one of the strongest colors, which is red, is not penetrating fully, and that's getting distributed throughout the atmosphere. So these principles are in everything, just like physics, just like math. You know, that 18 plus 3 is 21, no matter what we're talking about. Whether it's hamburgers or pencils or whatever it is universal. And you just have to keep changing the subject, the topic, let's say, for lack of a better word, so that people can understand the principles and the concepts. And here, you know, oh, camouflage, but let's get deeper into it. Not that we will now, although we could. You know, Navy guy, you may know that in World War II, we tried to dazzle paint our ships. It didn't work, but it looks, if you ever see pictures of these dazzle painted ships, where they tried to blend it in with the environment, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. And when you see zebras, you know, oh, you think that's because of camouflage, but it's actually not. It's it could be, in a way, because when they're running in a herd, one theory is, especially since most animals are colorblind, they see a herd with just a bunch of stripes blending in together, and it seems like one giant animal. And now the predators don't want to attack it. But there's another theory that it's actually to keep these insects away. There's lots of different things. Even in the Arctic, you know, I shouldn't have gone off on this tangent maybe, but it's definitely 100% related and everything. But just to show you where we could have gone with this, I mean, you see these animals like sharks or penguins or anything like that, they're half white, half black. Some of you may know, you know, students sometimes know that's called countershading. Countershading. Why is that? Because they want to be, when they're swimming in the water, a predator from above sees them dark, like a penguin, let's say, sees them dark, and they blend in with the water, the dark water. A predator from below sees above, and they blend in with the sunlight and light and everything, because they're light on the that side of them. So everything, you can get deeper and deeper and deeper into this, and you'll see how it relates to everything, including not only in modern times, but also in your day-to-day lives. Actually, the reason I thought of this is, what I was talking about is that vegetation on the plains evolved for a certain reason, against these windstorms and everything like that. That's how it evolved. But then we humans came into the area, and we tore it all up and started planting food crops, which is good for us until the storms start coming again, in which case now that's the wrong vegetation to hold the earth in where it was, and that's why you have what became known in America as the Dust Bowl. These storms would pick up all the soil. In a massive storm blowing at hundreds and hundreds of miles, it would blacken out the sky. If people actually thought the world was coming to an end, then frankly, I don't blame them. If you're there, humans and animals sometimes died of suffocation with this stuff filling their lungs. It buried crops, livestock, it clogged vehicles beyond repair. It was horrible, horrible. And what did these people on the Great Plains do, these farmers? These migrants, because a lot of them came from Oklahoma, they started calling all of them Okies, but really they came from multiple places, Arkansas, you know, Texas, wherever it was, and usually they went to California. They went to California looking for any kind of work or anything like that. And here, the same evolutionary principle and everything like that applies just as much. I mentioned to crime, you know, whether it be shoplifting or whatever it is at this time. Some of you have heard of John Dillinger. John Dillinger, he was a famous criminal. And he had a chip on his shoulder because when he was a kid and he was a minor, he had committed a small crime, and he got 10 years for it when he was young. And so the system really screwed him over, and he always had a grudge against it and against authorities and everything like that. And being in prison for all that time, he also learned how to be a really good criminal, unfortunately. He got paroled in 1933, and this Great Depression lasted really over a decade. Many people, if you technically put it, it's between like 1929 and 1933, but anybody who knows about it would say no, it went on until World War II, because it really was such a weak recovery and so sporadic and everything like that. It really, the Depression went on for over a decade. And so Dillinger is paroled during this time, and he gets out, and he is just completely out to get the authorities, and he will not follow the law. I mean, he gets locked up in a police station. What he does is he actually finds a way with a gun. He makes the janitor coming in open his cell door and let him out, and he locks the janitor in there. He does this with another cop who comes in, holds a gun on the person, puts him in. Another gun, over and over again. He eventually puts the entire police station in its own cell and locks them up. And just as he's leaving, he shows them the gun he used to break out of the cell to get the custodian to open up and everything like that. It was hand-carved out of either, I think it was wood, it may have been so, and blackened with shoe polish. That's what he did. Took the keys to the gun cabinet, took their guns, bulletproof vests, pistols, rifles, a Thompson submachine gun, which was a very new thing. Mostly only the Army had it. He got a Ford car with a V8 engine, another thing very few people had. He could even outrun the police. They couldn't catch him. And all law enforcement back then was local. They didn't have federal law enforcement. The FBI was created partly because of this, because the gangsters, criminals, they'd rob a bank or whatever it is, and then they'd outrun the police, and then they'd cross state lines, and there's nothing the police could do about it. They didn't have jurisdiction. So, and again, evolution, that's the FBI was created. But anyway, you have others. You have Dillinger was maybe the most famous, but you had Bonnie and Clyde. Who were they? You know, this couple, they would... they even stole a Kodak camera at some point and would take pictures of themselves. That's why we have these pictures of them. And another one, Machine Gun Kelly, not the current musician, the original one from which I'm sure he took his name. His wife gave him that name. His real name was George Barnes, but she said, "Oh, Machine Gun Kelly," and he could write his name on a barn door with a machine gun. She was kind of one of those people who sensationalizes things and stirs up trouble and everything like that. I mean, it wasn't true about him, but she reminds me of those girls who start a fight in a club just because they want to see you fight over them. But anyway, you see another one. Oh, my gosh. Babyface Nelson. Now, all these people were pretty extreme. I mean, you see Bonnie and Clyde, what happened is when they were finally cornered by law enforcement pumped, I think, over 100 bullets into the car they were in. And essentially, the law enforcement executed a number of these people. They didn't even want to bring them in. They executed them. And you see people like... Babyface Nelson actually got that name because he mugged I don't know if it was intentional or not, but he mugged the wife of a Chicago mayor. And then she told the newspapers, oh, he had such a baby face. He had a real baby face. But he was nuts. I mean, to the nth degree, he was completely nuts. Now John Dillinger, which he did encounter and everything like that, he's an extreme guy, and he eventually gets caught because one of his girlfriends, plural, he had girlfriends in different cities and everything like that, one of his girlfriends had a roommate, and when he was in town, he would take them both out on the town, the movies and everything, that sort of thing. He loved movies because the news was shown at the beginning of the movies, and they would talk about him, John Dillinger. So he loved to see his name and face and everything like that famous. But this girlfriend's roommate, who he would take out on the town, was a Romanian illegal immigrant, and she was afraid of getting deported. So she went to the feds and said, "You know what? I'll give you John Dillinger if you let me stay. My roommate is one of his girlfriends, and I'll tip you off when he comes in." Fed said, "Okay, we'll do it." And what happens is she actually wore an orange dress when he came in and took them both out on the town. She chose to wear an orange dress. What happens is she wants them to be easily identifiable to the FBI. So, okay, she wears this orange dress because who else is going to be wearing that? Now, there was a shoot to kill order on Dillinger as well. He had been making fools out of law enforcement and everything like that. So Hoover just says, "Okay, kill him as soon as you see him." And Dillinger senses that he's cornered when he's there at the movie theater, in front of the movie theater, and he jumps into an alley trying to escape, but it's too late. An agent shoots him in the back of the head, execution style, and he's dead. And people, this is John Dillinger. Wow. They ran over and dipped their handkerchiefs, men did, into dipping the corner into the pools of his blood just to have a souvenir there. His legend was so great that when his body was at the morgue, the county morgue, people would go there and actually thousands and thousands of them went there and stood in line for hours just to see his body, and then they got back in line just so they could do it again. That's how famous he was. And before we judge them as being too morbid or callous or whatever it is, I mean, remember, history is like a mirror. That's another thing we get from history, as I've said before. And, how much of that do we do in our own lives, our fascination with the morbid and macabre and the dangerous and things like that? When I mentioned Bonnie and Clyde, okay, they went into an ambush, and there was well over 100 rounds. They went down in a blaze of glory. But word spread, and, okay, these two are dead, and they came trying to tear off pieces of the car, cut locks of Bonnie's hair off as a souvenir. One guy actually tried to cut off Clyde's trigger finger as a souvenir, but he was stopped from doing it. So this is what was going on, but I mentioned, Babyface Nelson, when he linked up with Dillinger and everything like that, they were on this thing, and he spots an off-duty police officer, and he kills him, shoots him, and shouts, "Oh no, there's a cop!" Everybody else is running away. John Dillinger, everybody is running and hiding, trying to get away. What is Babyface Nelson doing? Outside this bank that they were probably going to rob, he's just spinning around, firing his machine gun wildly at storefronts, women, children, anything, and just laughing the entire time. That's what it is. He loved the violence. You see, later on, when they finally catch him, the government sets traps for all of these people, and it works. It usually works. Nelson, he gets a hole in the car's fuel tank or something like that, and he has to abandon the car. And then there are two FBI agents firing at him from behind their car, hiding from behind the car. Babyface Nelson, instead of ducking for cover, or even just staying where he is, he steps in the middle of the street and starts walking toward them, firing the entire time. He kills them both and walks away with 17 bullets in him. And then he dies later. But that's where he has the dubious distinction of killing more FBI agents than anyone had in history. And that's what it is. He reminds me of the scene in Batman with Heath Ledger's Joker, where the Joker is walking toward as Batman is racing toward him on a motorcycle. The Joker just walks toward him. Come on, I want you to do it. Come on, come on. As soon as I saw that years ago, I thought of Babyface Nelson. Maybe that's where they even got the idea for it. I don't know. And here, yes, we're learning about these prominent things in history. It is valuable, of course, to know about history. But what did I tell you about geometry? We don't learn geometry, even though the teachers don't know this. We don't learn geometry for the sake of learning about shapes and this and that. We learn geometry so we can build up our ability to conceptualize, to go from abstract to concrete and vice versa. I gave examples of the law and justice and things like that. I said, why do we learn foreign languages? Why would I learn Japanese when everybody in Japan speaks English? Why would somebody learn a dead language? Because it gives us a new way of looking at things. We can put a new way of thinking, I explained. And here with history, there are so many reasons for it, so many valuable things. And if you love life, you have to love history. Because history is 6,000 years of life all across the entire world. Now, I am not one of those people who really likes the drama of history. I do. You know, these famous people and dynamic action and event. I like it. Okay, I like it. But really, it's for the lessons it can teach us. Just as we learn lessons from life, our personal history, we can learn so much more from the whole history of the world. And we learned so many abilities as well. And in this case, it always kind of bothered me with this kind of stuff. When we talk about the Nazis soon, I mean, frankly, even warfare. I know a good amount about military history, and these are people really getting badly hurt. So yeah, these are real people. You see what a body looks like, what bullets do to flesh, what they do to brains. What a human body looks like when a tank has run over it. And these are not only for these people, they have usually families and loved ones and everything like that. And what about the Nazis? You know, what about these gangsters here? Oh, you know, it's wow, they're really bold and this and that. But these FBI agents who died, you know, what about them? What about their families? What about their kids? Everything like that. And so I always felt conflicted about this kind of stuff and how to even deal with it. You know, why am I enjoying it or benefiting from it and everything like that when there's this other stuff? And after thinking about it a long, long time in the years, it's always, you know, going on in the back of our heads when we learn something. It's kind of subconsciously being thought about, and oftentimes I would consciously think about it too. And the thing is, even with these things like the Nazis, these evil, disgusting people and the horrible things they did, well, what's going on is that I learned a deeper lesson. And history is always teaching us these lessons. And this one for me was how to love something and hate it at the same time. And these are universal, timeless things, which not only apply just as much today or 1,000 years in the future, whatever, they apply in every level, you know, in our personal lives. I know a couple of you are married. You know what it is to love someone and hate them at the same time. Maybe with kids, you know, or your parents or whatever it is. You understand what it's like to love someone or something and hate them at the same time. It doesn't have to be a marriage or family or anything. It could be the boyfriend or the girlfriend or a job. Or the city of Miami, or, you know, say living in the city, I can certainly see why it's a love-hate type of thing. But see, it's easy to do one or the other. It's hard to do both, especially simultaneously. And that's part of being more sophisticated in our perceptions and being an adult and things like that. We learn to deal with complexity and nuance and see that things are complex and nuanced. It shows us new ways to see the world. I mean, here we use, most countries use what's called, since we're talking about the economy, GDP or GNP, gross domestic product or gross national product. Basically, how much the country has produced in a given year. They factor in all the debts and losses and expenses and everything like that. And then what is our GDP? What is our GNP? All this kind of stuff. Well, the nation of Bhutan in South Asia is the one country that has actually a happiness index. They measure every 5 years. They survey people, ask them hundreds of questions, everything like that, and they measure the happiness of the country. And that's a thing. You see, like that Vu Deja I told you about earlier, that thing where you see something familiar in a new way. Well, if you see, right around this time is when the game Monopoly was invented. But it was not the guy who got credit for it for years and years and years, and he got all the money and this and that. He actually stole that idea. He stole almost the entire game and took credit for it and everything like that from this woman, this Quaker woman, who invented the game. She called it the landlord's game. And actually, the game was meant to teach the problems of capitalism and actually encourage socialism. That's how the game of Monopoly came about, as a critique of capitalism to show, look, you can't win, you're not going to do it. And her particular problem was with unearned income, which is rent, rent is just, oh, these people who are wealthy and have these lands that they usually inherited from their parents or whatever it is, and then they charge people rent on it, they're making money for doing nothing. And so you really, the game was taught, was created to show the problems of that. And here you had all these things, especially because of the bank robberies. You know, a bank gets robbed, everybody thinks, oh, where's my money? I better go in and rush in and get my money. Even if the bank, which probably still could have survived just because it was one bank robbery, that's fine. But if everybody comes in and gets their money, there's no way the bank can pay that, and the bank has to shut down. So again, tie this in 10 different ways to what I've been saying, whether it's evolution or whatever. That's how this FDIC, which I told you about, came about, to insure your money. So if you had $100,000, and currently, if any of you have $250,000, will you marry me? No. What's going on is it is protected, it is insured, and everything like that. And everything, that's another of the many things we get from history. What you see, everything you see and hear and taste and feel is a result of something. It did not just magically appear. Things happened. There was a process, usually a lot longer of a process than we realize, and a lot more complex, and that's how things come up. You know, I would have liked to do a lecture on the history of McDonald's, especially since one of you works there, but that would have been cool. And showing how all these things, oh, that's another thing with this, you know, everything is everything. Just like with the sneakers and stuff like that, I told you, oh, this guy came up with it, this guy copied it and made it better and everything like that. That McDonald's Happy Meal, they did not just come up with that. There was another rival burger place that came up with this great idea, oh, let's sell the kids as well, let's target these kids, and let's make a special, you know, small cardboard box with smaller sized food, and colorful pictures on it, and let's even put in a little toy. And they called it a fun meal. And McDonald's said, oh yeah, let's copy that. And they called it a Happy Meal. So everything is connected, and everything is connected in very specific ways too. If you get enough examples of history, you'll see that. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt is really, that was the pivot point with, now there was huge government expansion. Federal government, mind you, what power government had was usually with the states. Now it really started changing much more so with the federal government. And the federal government took a much more active role in people's lives and in the economy. And that tended to get more and more until finally there were real problems in the 1970s. There was a very unusual situation called stagflation. What is that? very unusual situation where you have stagnation and inflation. That's almost never happens, because when things are stagnant, the economy is not moving, prices are going to stay the same, or they're not going to go up. So you'll have stagnation but no inflation. Or when there's inflation, it's because the economy is really moving and pumping and the money's flying all around and everything like that. So you'll have inflation, but you won't have stagnation. But for various reasons, probably because there were two big problems in the Middle East, and that sent oil prices skyrocketing. There was a revolution in Iran, and also because the United States helped Israel in a certain war, the Arab countries got together and prevented us from buying oil or increased the prices and everything like that. So the price of oil, which is used in so many things, every plastic depends on oil, you know, everything, you know, textiles and everything like that use oil. And so the price of everything skyrocketed. So that's a big thing. And the president at the time, Jimmy Carter, he really wasn't able to do anything about it. He was a Democrat. And in came Ronald Reagan. This is in the 1980s. In 1980, that's what it is, there was the Reagan Revolution. That was a textbook term of yours. And it brought a whole bunch of different groups together, old and new conservatives together, and that under Ronald Reagan. This was in 1980. And he came into the presidency a Republican. And he had this thing which became known as Reaganomics. Reaganomics. So basically cut government spending massively, cut taxes massively, or increase spending on the military and things like that, but basically cut taxes massively and reduce government interference in the economy. So he did that. This is during the early 1980s, and it actually caused Reaganomics was another textbook term of yours, a big economic downturn. Well, an economic downturn, and then a big economic expansion came after it, a long period of economic expansion. And after that, there was in the 1990s, early 90s, I think it was in 1993 is when it was approved, another textbook term of yours, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, N-A-F-T-A, which I had mentioned in class, I think, that basically tariffs, which I had mentioned earlier in this lecture, the tax on imported goods, we removed them from Mexico, the United States, and Canada, North America. So there was a free trade agreement where we could sell our goods to each other and everything like that without any taxes. And that actually caused a lot of issues over the decades, because now a lot of jobs went down to Mexico. Because why would these car makers want to pay $50 an hour to Americans, plus pay all these safety regulations and environmental regulations there, when they can pay someone in Mexico $14 an hour and not have to worry about fulfilling all those regulations and safety features and for the workers and everything like that? And Reagan's vice president, George Bush Sr., came after him. But there were problems in the economy. And again, people just blame the person on top. So George Bush Sr. lost to a man named Bill Clinton. Okay? And Bill Clinton was president for two terms, so 8 years. And then after that, George Bush Sr.'s son, George W. Bush, ran for president against Bill Clinton's vice president, Al Gore. And there was the election of 2000, which is famous here because Florida, it came so close that people couldn't even tell who was the president, because we were the deciding factor and our votes were so close we couldn't tell who won Florida. And so it raised a lot of these issues, and Bush v. Gore is another textbook term of yours. It raised a lot of questions about whether we should have an electoral college or not, and about the huge amount of money spent on campaigns. So that was an important case. And then still later, stuff that you guys may have experienced, not even 10 years ago, we had the Occupy Wall Street movement, if you remember. There were really two groups Occupy Wall Street was a big thing, where they started protesting in Zuccotti Park, this park, Zuccotti Park, in New York City's financial district. And essentially, even though the police ejected them, the Occupy movement, as it became known, became very prominent in people's minds and very well known, and people were saying, you know what, there really are a lot of inequities going on in business. The income inequality is very serious. These people at the top don't have any consequences for their behavior, everything like that. And there was another one a little bit earlier. You know, Occupy actually came up perhaps in opposition to this Tea Party. The Tea Party, because at the founding of our country, way before this class is supposed to cover, but at the founding of our country, you had the Boston Tea Party, where we didn't want to answer to these oppressive British and pay their taxes, so we dumped a bunch of tea in the water, in the ocean, rather than take it. And the Tea Party movement, this is again about 10 years ago, was a grassroots Republican movement. The Occupy movement was much more democratic and even had socialism in it and everything like that. But the Tea Party was a Republican movement, and it was really mobilized by opposition to President Barack Obama's legislations of healthcare and taxation and big government. So that the Tea Party is another textbook term of yours. And the Tea Party is not really known, not really making waves as itself, but that kind of idea, its ideas, the same, many of the same people involved, everything like that, are very active, especially because Barack Obama was seen as expanding government's role, expanding this, that, redistributing income. And so, as is typical in America and in history as a whole, the pendulum swings one way and then it kind of swings the other way. And those types of people tended to support Donald Trump. And Donald Trump became elected as President of the United States. And he was, now this was not what the Tea Party was known for. In fact, Republicans are usually in favor of free trade. As I said, they're the party of business. They always have been. But certainly either party, Democrats, Republicans, whatever it is what's called a big tent. When they say it's a big tent, it means a lot of different groups in it feel different ways and everything. And the Republicans, the conservatives, most of them were in favor of free trade because it helps business, but more and more and more of them were actually opposed to it because of the jobs going overseas, because of China would constantly take advantage of us in many ways, including stealing our intellectual property. They would frequently, I mean, business is the closest thing to war, other than war. And what would happen is, I've even had people in my class tell me, they would, somebody they worked with opened up a business, came up with a product, invented a product, had it produced at a factory in China, tried to get it produced, but there were different problems and delays and everything like that, or they couldn't get it right, they shipped the wrong thing, whatever it was. And then, lo and behold, someone else comes up with the same product, and it's being sold, and it's being produced properly. What happened was, in China, they stalled this guy long enough for them to be able to copy the product and start producing it on their own and make money on their own. And that's one example of what China has been doing. You know, it's seen as it's basically required that the businesses in China collect all the information they can about the products, services, and everything, and hand it over to the government. And any kind of computer program, anything the Chinese can copy, they will do that and then use it as their own. Now, mind you, this has gone on throughout history. America has done it. Other countries have done it. I gave the example, you know, Microsoft did it to Apple. Apple did it to Xerox. You know, it goes on, but China has been doing it excessively. And again, free trade. A lot of people are wondering, where have all the jobs gone? Where is You know, where's our industrial base gone? What if we go to war? And here is an example, coincidentally, with the coronavirus. You know, now we need this stuff. Our PPE, our personal protection equipment, is being made in China. And so when we really need it, we can't get it. Whereas if we had kept it domestic as a protected industry, we would have been able to produce whatever we need when we need it. And so a lot of things are changing now. As I said, evolution. The economy is no different. This is what it is, and wise people change with it. So, lessons for all of us. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.